Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think, I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Griffin. I'm sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day and welcome back to Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations at ANU. And with me, as is customary, is the wonderfully insightful political scientist, Dr. Maria Taflaga, also from the School of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Mark. Hello, everyone.
And a regular guest who can never be too regular for our liking is Professor Frank Bongiorno from the ANU's School of History. Frank, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Mark, and Happy New Year if it's not too late to do that. I know.
I think it might be, actually. I saw someone getting quite irate about this the other day on social media somewhere saying that, you know, sorry, you've surrendered the right once you get past about the second week of January to talk about the new year. And I think maybe even if that's a bit tight, second, third week of...
What rubbish. February. What rubbish.
Happy Valentine's Day then.
That's the one. Now, we're actually pretty much the same crew, as you would know, that wound up the year in 2021, the year, of course, that was supposed to be better than 2020 but wasn't. And since our last show in mid-December, a bit of a shambolic show it was too, good fun, Omicron has ravaged the community, the polity, and many people's sanity, I think it's fair to say. Maria, without the assistance of a ukulele, perhaps you can tell us what happened politically. I mean, I'm not asking you to go through the events, but it was pretty much not the way Scott Morrison was hoping to be retooling for an election year, was it?
No, it definitely wasn't the hot vax summer TM that we were all promised. And I guess if we were to sort of look at it, I guess from the very long view or very out of zoomed out, it was, I guess, the point in the cycle of the pandemic where what was probably always inevitable, that we would have an outbreak of high numbers of infections, occurred. But I guess the unfortunate thing from the Prime Minister's perspective was his failure to really prepare for it. And I note the other day or the other week he sort of said no one anticipated the Omicron variant, which, you know, upon reflection, I think is actually quite an extraordinary comment. I mean, we're living in a pandemic. There's really, it's like a war, right? Like, you know, it's not realistic to expect governments to get every decision right, especially when the wrong decision is pretty catastrophic. But equally, it's sort of beggars belief that after almost 3 years of this, that you wouldn't think that there might be another variant coming, particularly when global vaccination rates are what they are.
Yeah, well, it is really interesting, isn't it, Frank, because the government obviously lost a lot of paint in 2020, the federal government particularly in 2020, with the very sort of lackadaisical approach it took to the procurement of mRNA vaccines in particular.
the purchasing of Pfizer, for example, internationally, but other ones as well through 2020. And that's when we, of course, had the famous it's not a race excuse offered by the Prime Minister rather disastrously. But nonetheless, we don't need to reprise all of that, but you would have thought that in political terms at least, that kind of becomes a bit of a near-death experience, and if you're the government, you're hyper alert to the risks associated with that, especially as an election looms. So when you put it in that context, and you get to the end of November, going into the summer, thinking about how summer is an optimistic time, thinking about how you're going to be coming out of that summer and going to an election, and thinking about the risks to that. It's pretty amazing to have the best the government can offer is, well, no one saw Omicron coming.
Yeah, I think a lot of wishful thinking kicked in. I suppose my theory has always been that Morrison was probably looking at an election late last year on the back of a highly successful vaccination program achieved, in a kind of steady rather than racy way over 2021. And, of course, that's not how things panned out. I mean, I suppose my own take on this is that it also speaks to kind of incapacities of federal government. It's easy to blame a particular incumbent and
exactly.
a particular prime minister. But, again, as a historian who obviously, has looked at the history of government capacity in different contexts over, more than a century, this has been a very bad news story. I mean, it suggests that federal government, is in a lot of ways less capable now than perhaps at any point in the past. I mean, you think of the kinds of reorganisation that have been involved in prosecuting wars, indeed administering a vaccination program in 1919. It wasn't quite a program, but it was certainly, a process in which the Commonwealth was very heavily involved back in the Spanish flu. And quite frankly, they did it more efficiently then than they did this time. So, I think it does speak also to, that issue of, what is our government actually capable of? Have they farmed out too many of their skills and functions to the private sector? It's not just, I think, a story of the Morrison government, but it will be the Morrison government, of course, that looks like it will carry the can.
I think that's a really good point that you make there, Frank, right? And the I guess the most obvious litmus test of that is that it's the army that is constantly deployed to fix problems because it's one of the few domains that the federal government controls people, right? People who
can
do things.
Presumably it's like a standing capacity the whole time, unlike many other things. It's largely ideally underutilized because we're not in a constant state of conflict or emergency, but that's what it's there for.
Yeah, but this whole thing I think speaks to the fact that it's a pattern actually, which is that a lot of decisions made about the pandemic have been made through a really political lens rather than a sort of public policy or problem-solving lens. We're sort of having an echo of a conversation we had about the GP rollout of vaccines. Why were the GPs selected? Because that was a domain that the federal government had more responsibility for. It means they could take the credit for a successful vaccine rollout, which of course became a total shambles. And the Prime Minister sort of said that he regretted not bringing in the army earlier, which I thought, again, was a really curious thing to say, because perhaps the regret was actually not just giving this function to the states who have the capacity and know-how and people to deliver such a thing as a vaccine rollout.
It's a really good point too, because that's what, this point about having not handed it over to Lieutenant General John Frewen earlier, or to the army and presumably to him earlier. It was a Clayton's apology for a start that came at that rather shambolic National Press Club appearance, which was supposed to be Morrison's chance to reframe the political debate, reset it, start to, in a sense, controlling the agenda as governments like to going into any year, but particularly an election year. And he didn't really apologise for a whole lot of things. He spoke about a lot of things that had caused umbrage and anxiety in the community, but he didn't really apologise. And so when pushed to be a bit more specific, that was the thing he nominated that he wished, with hindsight, that it should have been handed to the military earlier. And my immediate reaction was, apart from the fact that's not really an apology, was it sort of contained this message that, well, you know, eventually I thought of the answer here. I just wish I'd thought of it earlier. And it goes to Frank's point also that is that what we've done now? We've so kind of hollowed out the capacity of the Federal Public Service to do these sorts of things or to do much at all, really. I mean, remember Morrison basically told them a couple of years ago, you're there for service delivery, we do the ideas. Turns out they're not there for even the service delivery. It does speak to this, as I say, this kind of hollowing out of the capacity of government, as you were saying, Frank.
Well, yes, there's the army and then there's the consultancy firms. I think the pandemic has exposed the problem with federal government essentially outsourcing really core functions, core policy making functions to effectively these companies. It's not working. It's not producing good policy. The issue of vaccine procurement is a really interesting one. I mean, I speak to economist colleagues here at the ANU, and you know, this wasn't brain surgery, but you know, there is a well-known sort of series of techniques that can be used that basically provide kind of hedging in a process like that, and that was deployed in the United States, even during the shambolic period of Trump's final year as president. Quietly, those processes were going ahead. Here, we seem to have put, you know, all of the eggs in one basket, with you know, pretty dire results as it turned out. This is just bad policymaking, and it speaks, I think, to problems in the kinds of expertise that the federal government is actually able to draw on. The expertise exists, often exists quite close to hand. It certainly exists in Australia, but you know, these are recognised areas of kind of public policy and economics expertise, and the government appears not to have drawn on it. You have to ask yourself why.
Yeah, and it's as you say, it's poor policy development, but it's also poor risk management. In an emergency, risk management is absolutely critical. And I don't just mean political risk management. I mean the danger to the community. And the thing about Omicron, the first case of it was that showed up in Australia, I think it was 28th of November, right? So it took a little while for that to manifest into sort of serious numbers and for, I guess, many people in the Australian community to start, you know, really worrying about it as a sort of a clear and present danger. But it had been spoken about for months before that, after showing up in Southern Africa and then in some other places in Europe. And there were real question marks about whether it was more virulent and whether it was more dangerous or less dangerous, and much of that was unknown. And yet it seemed like there was this kind of parallel track of kind of almost, you know, laissez-faire political debate going on in Australia, where we'd sort of come through the winter and come through the worst of it, particularly the worst of Delta, it seemed, and we had high levels of vaccination. And there was this sunny optimism, if I can put it like that, about going into the summer and getting life back to normal and having the economy grow. And this new risk factor that had emerged in the back of our minds, speaking collectively and sort of rolling in the government there, just didn't seem to be taken very seriously. And that's poor risk management. It's poor political judgment, which I think has become a feature of this government. Very poor public health policy. And you don't imagine it would have been the advice of a conscientious, front-footed public health department were it in a, you know, very prominent position in the decision-making process of the government.
Well, is it a new discovery that viruses mutate? I wouldn't have thought so. This should have been factored into policymaking from March 2020. But, you know, as I said, I think a lot of wishful thinking kicked in. It became pretty clear, I think, probably around the spring last year that Morrison had a particular pitch which he was going to take to the next election, which was, you know, Scotty is the great liberator. He was going to free Australians from their bondage and show them how to live with the virus. What was the old phrase? To stop worrying about the bomb or whatever it was back from the old days. And, you know, as it turned out, it was a disastrous summer from that perspective. And most of his political problems now actually have arisen from the failure of that narrative that I think he is very comfortable with, the idea of people being able to enjoy the Australian way of life free from the kinds of restrictions that we've all been under in the last couple of years, and some of us more than others, of course. And that, you know, has turned, well, thoroughly pear-shaped because of Omicron. And you know, that's the fundamental problem he's got at the moment.
Well, that's the thing I find quite kind of fascinating. Like, I don't think it's illegitimate for a civilian government to take a position on, a calculated risk, right, about when to open up society. What I did find quite bizarre, and it kind of goes to everything you've just sort of both said, which is, you know, like the failure to sort of anticipate what would be required to be in place to keep the economy open, right? Like, you know, you can criticize the government for taking, you know, in some ways, definitely an ideological choice, but, you know, all of these public policy decisions are informed by ideology. We shouldn't pretend that they aren't. But then to not sort of, you know, have the rapid antigen test system in place, as it was in the UK, in effect, which is one of the things that allowed the economy there to stay open for as long as it could, and kind of was a bit of a band-aid on like many of the other systemic problems going on in the United Kingdom. I think that there's sort of like a chronic failure to learn from obvious parallels overseas, but also obvious mistakes that we've made here. And I just think that's really very interesting. And perhaps it points to a level of exhaustion, or perhaps it's simply hubris, or it's just a disposition, you know, an optimistic disposition, which makes what seems like on paper quite a risky bet in your own mind due to human psychology, like a not nearly as risky a bet. I don't know.
Look, I think that's an absolutely excellent point. You know, was it exhaustion? Was it hubris? Was it a failure of imagination, naivety? Whatever it was, you're right. I mean, why wasn't, if you were going to go down the path that you say, all right, we think we now are in a position where we can sort of build forward looking to a much more open economy, and there will be great benefits for this, you would think that you would buttress that with the relevant mechanisms for handling it if your judgment turns out to be wrong. If the circumstances change, how do we handle it? How do we pivot from that? Instead, it turned out that wasn't. We were just all in on this idea that it was going to be let's leap forward into the bold new economy. Don't worry about Omicron. It's a bit of a side story. It turns out not to be a side story, and we've done nothing about getting rapid antigen testing out there and putting in place those systems, and knowing that there are going to be kids going back to school, families that are going to be facing this uncertainty, all kinds of problems with the aged care system and everything else. I could go on. I'll take a break there, and we'll come back in just a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, before the break, we were talking obviously about the Omicron omni-shambles, I guess you'd call it, the failure of the government to sort of plan for the contingency of things going pear-shaped. What was your description of it, Maria?
Oh, I thought of it as daggy dad planning, you know. She'll be right, mate. We'll just put some gaffer tape on it. She'll float. It'll be good.
Yeah, and it does seem to, yeah, there's sort of, there was that kind of, as I say, kind of a naivety, sort of a simple idea that, well, you know, we're getting through this. I wonder whether what both of you think about the role, just briefly, the role of the arrival of Perrottet in New South Wales and his more kind of laissez-faire approach. Did sort of Morrison and Perrottet, obviously the biggest state and Morrison's home state and all of that, do you think they kind of almost egged each other on along a process of sort of, you know, get the state out of our lives kind of thing, and this played a role in Australia not really being as prepared as it could have been for Omicron?
It's possible. I mean, you know, there's no real love lost between Dominic Perrottet and Scott Morrison. They're from rival factions. It would have been, I guess, the sort of mid-game of what is now the end game of the sort of factional manoeuvrings going on in that state that has seen a failure to pre-select candidates very close to the election.
It's been a dog's breakfast, hasn't it? I mean,
it has been. I mean, I think, you know, Perrottet very much enjoyed, I guess, burnishing his credentials, and perhaps there was an element of reaction upon Morrison's part. But
he did plenty himself too, though, to be fair. I mean, I agree with what you've just said, but he was very kind of bullish about getting rid of masks and reducing the restrictions on Sydneysiders just as the bloody Omicron thing's taking off. Now, he didn't change course for weeks.
I mean, I guess this is the interesting point, right? With Dominic Perrottet, we kind of know where his views on this matter come from. You know, they clearly come from his coherent ideological position about the role of the state in society. Whereas with Scott Morrison's position, like, is that really what he thought, or is that what was being fed back to him in focus groups? Or is it simply just a clear point of differentiation between, you know, Labor, the Labor states, and his own government? And that to me is actually interesting, that it's not clear what motivated that.
I think it's, I mean, it's a good question, and I suppose my sort of half answer to it would be that, think of how Morrison has promoted his kind of image as Prime Minister from day one, really. I mean, he unveiled it really in January 19, a few months before that election. And it was the idea of the kind of, you know, carefree Australians, the quiet Australians, or quieter Australians, as he called them initially, who, you know, are able to quietly get on with the things that they love doing, you know, their SUVs on weekends and, you know, off to the rugby league and all the rest of it. I think that narrative of you know, throwing off the restrictions and living with the virus and getting our freedoms back was deeply attractive to Morrison. Whether we call it ideology or not, I don't know, but I think it's bound up within a particular persona that he's maintained as Prime Minister. And, of course, you couldn't maintain that in a particularly flamboyant or effective way, you know, when we're all locked down and things are extremely dangerous. But I think when the opportunity arose I suppose towards the end of 2020, really, but certainly in 2021, he kind of returned or reverted to what was, you know, his kind of instinctual way of thinking about himself as Prime Minister.
I think that's a really good point, and it's actually probably quite sort of succinctly put, as sort of when we think about the restrictions and the measures that the federal government put in place, that he was late in and early out, that he was quite reluctant when we think about those early weeks and months of 2020. He did eventually, he moved reasonably quickly on the international border, but, you know, the evidence was very compelling there. But he was still talking about going to the footy and all of those things that we know about. That showed that he took some time to kind of get his head around what it was that a national government needed to do and how serious was the threat and therefore the changes that we all needed to make, that government needed to reposition, that Australians needed to be, have it communicated to them that things were serious and needed to change and needed to change immediately. Morrison was quite sort of, you know, slow and reluctant in and faltering in a number of the ways that he went about that. And the government, for example, we've spoken about this before, Canberra at least, you know, the federal government was quite reluctant really to talk about masks for a lot longer after other jurisdictions, both the states but also other countries were very strong on masks. And we just didn't get much coming from the federal government. And then we look at this, you know, we've had some tidiness about various measures along the way, vaccines in particular, and then this kind of almost rush to come out of it when perhaps there's some pretty good evidence that, hang on, this isn't over yet. There's still some shooting to be done, and so we get into this awkward situation that he finds himself now.
And it makes sense from a political perspective. In a way, right? Like, it's a positive narrative. It differentiates himself from the carping of the left writ large, and the sort of Labor states. But what else is kind of interesting about, I guess, that early kind of narrative building around this was that, you know, if you remember, he was sort of trying to have a bob each way. You know, he's sort of trying to sort of talk out of two sides of his mouth in relation to the people who were increasingly angry about vaccine mandates, who are now sort of, you know, camped outside the lawns on Parliament House and various other places in Canberra. And then, you know, just the sort of, I guess, recognising the sort of fatigue that it had set in across the eastern seaboard, where, you know, the majority of the population had been having a rather miserable winter. And I guess, and it's a seductive idea, you know, like it's something that you would want to sort of believe yourself. And I guess that is the downside of having such an optimistic worldview or sensibility, because I think that's what you're sort of pointing to, Frank. It's a sensibility that he has rather than necessarily one that comes from ideology, which is why it's malleable and incoherent so often.
Yeah, I think it is. I think sensibility is a good word for what I'm getting at. It's a sensibility. It's, you know, we also need to keep coming back to his being a PR man, and he's a professional image maker, and I think a part of that sort of shift towards, you know, really optimistic emphasis on opening up and getting back to normal life was also, you know, about a certain image of him as a political leader and of his government and of what his government stands for that is actually very important. It's probably important to him in an emotional sense, but it's also just critical to him in terms of political survival and political, you know, his political future. I mean, if he doesn't stand for something like that, what does he stand for? I mean,
well, what does doesn't he stand for?
He doesn't stand for fiscal rectitude, that's for sure. We know that. No. So he's not Malcolm Fraser telling us life wasn't meant to be easier. In fact, he tells us the exact opposite. Life is meant to be easy, and I'm going to help to make it easy for you. And the reality of our lives in the last couple of years is, in fact, for many people, they've been other than easy, and he hasn't always been the best prime minister for dealing with that.
So does that mean, Maria, that he's a prime minister for the good times? The trouble is we're not in good times.
Oh, that's a great question. Probably. I mean, I would say most prime ministers are prime ministers for the good times, which is why they fall over when they really
hit the best ones.
Yeah, when they hit roadblocks. But I, you know, listening to you guys talk, it makes me think about the 60 Minutes sort of puff piece thing, and
it was very hard hitting.
It was in terms of cringiness, sure, it was definitely hard hitting. But it does kind of emphasize that after 3 years as prime minister, we're actually almost coming up to four, right? Mm-hmm. He is essentially trying to campaign on, you know, trademark Scott Morrison, right? Not his record, not his future plan.
He has no record.
Well, that's right. Well, he does. It's not a good record, though.
But there's no big legislative legacy here. We don't see any significant reform legacy. I mean, the debacle last week over religious freedom was, or however you want to call it, was, you know, unedifying, pointless, took a lot of paint off the Prime Minister and everything else. But, you know, they're the things he's most noted for. Parliament is not his friend. Even though government is formed in the House of Representatives, you have to have a majority in the reps to be the government or command a majority. And yet he hasn't had that. So, yeah, it's a really interesting question as to how we understand this Prime Minister. Did he win in 2019, Maria, for example, because he was unknown but not particularly disliked? And is that avenue just not open to him anymore? For a start, he is known. And although he's not, I don't think we should pretend that he is profoundly disliked in the community, because the polls don't show that. They do show Albanese gaining on him quite considerably, almost level pegging on preferred PM in some indexes. But he's not, you know, toxic in that sense with ordinary voters. But ordinary voters know this man now, and they've had some pretty frank, you know, what I've called them textimonials from we've seen recently, the text exchanges we've seen, from others. And we've, of course, you know, and Macron, of course, and you know, around the place. I mean, he's a known commodity now. So who is he? What does he stand for? There's no record. And the stuff we hear from the people who know him best is not particularly inspiring.
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of answers to this. The first one is, right, normally I would say if you want a friend in politics, get a dog. But I guess when you are a political figure that has effectively become or come to the position you have marketing yourself, where, as you say, you have no policy legacy and you've only got a management legacy, right? If you're trying to basically say, hey, I'm still a good bloke, then I do think all of this sort of ephemera around the Prime Minister's character suddenly does become kind of important. And I struggle to think, apart from Julia Gillard, right, where these kinds of questions were so important, like front and center, and I guess it kind of throws up in relief. It's because there isn't a narrative of competence, policy doing, or a legacy of any kind to really kind of be able to point to unambiguously. So he is kind of left with, yeah, you know, like the vibe of who he is and and how he kind of feels about things. And last week was so disastrous because, you know, supposedly he cares about religious freedom and he sincerely promised to do something for his communities, right, and his people, which he has now failed to do. He also, instead of like really focusing on landing the win, right, and managing the politics within his own party, instead tried to turn it into a political opportunity to hurt Labor, which is completely blown up in his face. And now, what, you know, they have to go to the next election saying, you know, they'll promise sincerely, hand on heart, to do it again. When we have all of these narratives about him and his word, like, I just, it's, you know, it's actually a far worse look than I think it appears at first blush.
That's absolutely right. Frank, I mean, the ukulele playing was, as Maria said, pretty cringeworthy. I'm not sure what the calculus is there in terms of his PR team, his strategy, his sense of what he's trying to project. I guess it is the sort of everyman, the guy who cooks curry on a Saturday night and sits around with a family in a T-shirt and boardies and can pull out the ukulele, whether it be here or in Hawaii, because you can pack a ukulele quite well and scarper off, national emergency notwithstanding. But the thing that worried me, just, and this we'll probably have to end here, but the thing that worried me, Frank, on that whole frame of information that we got wasn't so much that, but the statement where he says that, he prays. Okay, we know he's a Christian and all that, but he almost wore the carpet out next to his bed in Canberra praying for Australia during the pandemic. And I thought, well, you know, given that we didn't, you know, open our wallet and get the vaccines anywhere near as quickly as we might have, you know, the phrase that came to my mind was don't pray for it, pay for it. You know, we certainly do that in so many other ways. We've been dishing out money to employers that didn't need it. We've been, you know, handing away money or hand over fist on defense projects, as we know. But you know, just as a sort of a serious point, Frank, you know, could being that, projecting an image of being that kind of pious, does that really resonate well with Australia, which is still largely a secular nation?
Yeah, look, I found it interesting last night. I probably wouldn't have watched it unless, you know, we were coming to Democracy Sausage today, but I did. And I think you can kind of work backwards from, you know, the main emphases of the whole sort of segment. The strengths that he's clearly playing to are the one you just mentioned, and I think it still remains a strength. I mean, my guess is their focus groups are telling them, or their research is telling them, that the religious convictions of the Prime Minister remain a positive from the point of view of probably many Australians. They like the idea that, you know, he's not afraid to be open about his religious belief, and I mean, I don't know, but I suspect that isn't a negative for him even now, even in a country that perhaps, you know, likes to think of itself as secular. The good family man image is clearly something that is still a commodity, an asset. It was mentioned, for instance, by, I think, one of the generally thoughtful respondents on Four Corners a week ago, you know, that the image of him as a good family man is still believed, and I suspect it is authentic. But what's equally interesting, you know, it's pretty clear they were addressing a number of issues that remain alive for voters. And the one that really jumped out and hit me in the face is Hawaii and those bushfires. It's pretty clear, I think, from what we saw last night and the fact that they did address this and they spent so much energy and time addressing it, or rather Jenny did, that voters still associate that moment with Morrison's style as a prime minister, the fact that he doesn't hold the hose, the fact that he went missing and had a holiday when the country was in crisis. It's clear that that has stuck in voters' minds and they do not like it. They are holding it against him even now. The other issues that came through, of course, he's clearly got a problem with the women's vote generally, and particularly the handling of those, all the issues around, you know, sexual assault and all the rest of it that have resonated over the last year in Parliament House and more generally in the community, and the one we've been talking about, the pandemic response and particularly aged care. So, you know, assuming that they were addressing issues last night that, you know, are coming through in their research as problematic for the government, I found that quite interesting. I mean, the idea of your wife doing that work, I think it's easy to overlook just how novel last night was in that sense. Now, there's been a lot of nonsense spoken, I think, in the last few days. They all do it. They use their families and all the rest. I have never seen a prime minister use his wife as a kind of political shield like we saw last night. The closest I could come to, and it was a very different set of circumstances, was 1984, Bob Hawke, Hazel Hawke, and the heroin addiction of one of the Hawke's daughters. It was Rosalind. Now, you know, in that particular instance, of course, they sent Hazel out to the Mike Walsh Show, I think it was, to basically explain what had happened to the family. But the circumstances kind of seemed to call for that. You know, you could see why in that situation it would be, you know, that a spouse might be sent out to talk about the family. It was midday television and all the rest of it. Quite different, I think, from what we saw last night. But, you know, that was the closest I could think of. I mean, the idea of just, he kind of sat there in a sort of almost ornamental way while a bunch of questions about really his failures as Prime Minister were directed at his wife. I've never seen that. I wasn't expecting it, and I think it's worth a lot more attention than it so far had.
I think it sort of encapsulates the inability for him to actually take responsibility. You know, he's not even doing this job. I just find that, you know, seriously, like it is strange. It's passing strange, Frank, and listening to you kind of stretch for historical parallels seems to have kind of underlined this for me?
Well, I can't think of anything. I mean, I recall Tony Abbott, obviously, his daughters were conspicuous as a part of his attempt to show that he really did get women's issues and understood them well and all the rest of it. But that, you know, was about a kind of political symbolism. It's quite different from what we saw last night. And certainly, you know, the idea of the soft-focused interview with the family, there's nothing new about that. That's certainly
that's
been
right.
around for some time, but not what we saw last night. And I think that's where, and you're right, I think that one of the ways you could read what we saw is a kind of admission that you know, he's sort of not up to it. Now, I'm not suggesting people will necessarily read it that way, but it does, you know, it had its risks, I think, what we saw last night. And it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out because, as we know with these things, you can't really judge the way they work politically from what you get in the first 24 hours. It simply doesn't work. If that were the case, you know, the bushfires wouldn't have been so terribly damaging, or Hawaii wouldn't have been damaging, because
yeah,
I can remember
exactly.
a lot of media coverage at the time. A lot of journos were telling us, oh, look, he deserves a holiday. Every family deserves a holiday. Leave him alone. Well,
yeah.
that's not how it's turned out. And we might find that last night, you know.
Well, one of the interesting sort of things presence. about it, we'll have to end there because we are over time, but one of the interesting things about that bushfire thing is that bushfire point and the discussion of it, the resonance, you know, with the ukulele and Hawaii and the outfits and everything else, you know, it comes 24 hours after the Bega by-election where there's an 18% swing against, or 14% I think was the swing, 18% swing in Willoughby, but 14% swing against the government. It falls to Labor for the first time ever after I think it was 18 years held by Andrew Constance. And people down there tell me it wasn't Omicron, it wasn't the pandemic generally, it was the bushfires. The bushfires is an absolutely huge issue in that part of the country, and it's probably a huge issue in the minds of many people. And that really just sort of underlines the point, this hasn't gone away. And you could scarcely sort of reduce that political crisis down more efficiently than to, you know, re-utter the words, I don't hold a hose, mate, which sort of seems to say everything. Look, thank you both for what's just been a fantastic discussion. There's a whole range of things we haven't been able to get to, which we will do through the course of the next few weeks, no doubt. Things like the way Albanese is performing, the way he's being framed by the government. We haven't talked about the crisis in Ukraine and even not so much from a, you know, what's happening their point of view, but from the potential that a big global conflict may have on the impact of impact on Australian domestic politics. Could that change the calculus? There's a range of things going on, so much more we can talk about. We're looking forward to a big year on Democracy Sausage, of course, an election year, always interesting, and we're hoping to get across all of these issues as we go along. Don't forget to reach out to us. Of course, you can find us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, or send us an email to podcast@policyforum.net. You can join our Facebook group. Just type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar. We'd also love you to subscribe to the show, of course, and leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. So Maria Tafaga and Frank Bongiorno, thanks again for kicking us off in 2022. Should be a big year.
Thanks.
Oh, it will be.
Yes. Thanks,
bye,
Maria.
Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Until next week.
Bye, Frank.
Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.